Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. The Champions League is back and so are we. Today we'll be discussing all four English teams and their efforts in this week's competition. We'll also be looking at the other things that we spotted during the week's action and we'll be looking ahead to a massive week in the Premier League this weekend. Joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got Martin Samuel, Chief Correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, Football Correspondent for The Sunday Times, and our favourite former footballer turned journalist, Gregor Robertson. Now, gents, after the roaring success of my opener last week, you know, you remember it, don't you, Martin?
Yeah, oh, mate, we were still laughing about it.
Englishman, Irishman,
hours,
Scotsman walking to a
hours
podcast.
Later, yeah.
I thought I'd start this one with another joke. Manchester United.
Oh, here we go.
See what you did.
Yep. See what I did there? Yep. Too harsh?
No, no.
Too harsh?
A lot of people switching off.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of furious letters to the editor.
I'm trying. No, we're not going to be that harsh. We're going to have a considered debate around Manchester United because they lost 4-3 to Bayern Munich. Hopes, dreams, aspirations. But it was pretty dire, wasn't it? I was in the editing chair last night in the Times offices. And to be honest, I was writing the back page story for the newspaper, which we have to do quite quickly to turn it around in time for the deadline. And I was writing it at 4-2 and I kind of was being quite downcast about United's chances. And then they went 4-3 and I thought, do I have to pretend that this was close? And kind of did a quick survey of the editors, quick survey of the sub-editors who were in the office, and we all agreed that no, I did not have to pretend that it was close. Johnny, been a while since you've been with us. I'm going to start with you. What did you make of that performance in general? And how are you looking at United now after this opening period of the season?
Yeah, well, I felt it was kind of poignant or telling that performance came on the day Ole Gunnar Solskjaer broke his silence.
Yes,
my old pal Ole. Yeah. But it just kind of reminded you of the fact United are just in this never-ending cycle. It would seem post Ferguson, where there's a little bit of progress and then optimism's raised, and then for many reasons. But probably one central reason, recruitment, they fall back again. And it feels very much like United have started the season having gone over the hill of that curve and are now back down towards, I think they're heading towards crisis. That's not a kind of tabloid way of saying it. I think that's realistic. They can't keep losing games. They can't keep shipping goals. And more at the point, they can't keep playing like a small team. And that's what I thought about last night's performance. Was it was a dominant, proper modern football side with quality on the ball, with a game plan, not even in their top gear, but dominating a match and won the opposition trying to hang on. And then you look at the names of the teams, and it's Manchester United, Bayern Munich. It shouldn't be that way. I've watched Bayern in their in a couple of the Bundesliga games this year, they had more trouble against Leverkusen, who are a good side. On Friday, they had far more trouble against RB Leipzig. United are just not anywhere near that level at the moment. And Gregor and I were speaking about this before we came on. Another thing that hits you over the head watching United is looking at that team and thinking, where has all the money gone? Mm. When you look at what's on the pitch at the moment, you do not see see a team that's been built to the cost of what, £400-500 million since even Ten Hag arrived.
Yes.
So very little progress, and I think the final thought would be, where is the Ten Hag style? Mm. I'm not seeing it yet, and I thought after last season this would be the season where we'd start to see more of how he wanted to play, and it's certainly not come so far in this campaign.
Yeah, there was a moment last night when the bench flashed up and there was Johnny Evans, Hannibal Medbury and Anthony Martial sat next to each other, and I thought, I hope they get a 3-0 lead quick here because we might not turn this around. Martin, on Johnny's point there about the squad but also about Ten Hag's style, did you see any kind of bits of promise in terms of what the manager was offering in terms of his selections last night and his tactics?
Look, I haven't seen that in Manchester United really this season. I mean, I keep coming back to the Arsenal game that people were talking about it as if it was some massive corner turned, and I couldn't see it, and I wrote that I couldn't see that, and, you know, furious people on the bottom of the column, you've got it in for Manchester United. I'm sorry, Arsenal were much, much better. The way that Bayern Munich were much, much better. The way that Tottenham were much, much better. And Brighton were much, much better. And actually, Wolves were much, much better as well. And, I mean, apart from that period where they take the game back from Nottingham Forest, I haven't seen Manchester United be much, much better than anybody at any stage in this campaign. Mm. And that's not because I've got some irrational grudge against Manchester United. There's no reason why that would be the case. I wrote very positively about the impact that Ten Hag made last season, but I'm not seeing it. And last night was a 4-3 that we all know wasn't. Because if you divide the game up into its three constituent parts, then it's level for 28 minutes, it's Bayern Munich ahead for 62 minutes, and it's Manchester United ahead for 0 minutes. Mm. So it's not one of those 4-3s that is veering from one team to the other or whatever. It's not. It's a 4-3 that flattered United. And that on two occasions when Manchester United got a tiny foothold in the game, Bayern Munich just went up the other end and scored.
Yeah.
And then they didn't when it was 4-3 because they ran out of time. Yeah. And they'd taken Harry Kane off, and they'd taken Musiala off, and they'd taken all of the best players on the night off who were all playing for Bayern Munich. So, yeah, it's worrying. They're going to Burnley on Saturday. Burnley haven't beaten them at Turf Moor since 2009. Johnny Evans was in the Manchester United team that day as well, and he could still be in it on Saturday. He probably won't be, but he could still be in it. And if Burnley were to beat them, you can't say it's a great shock.
No.
You'd be surprised. If you had to have a bet, you'd put your money on Manchester United for obvious reasons. But it wouldn't be a great shock in the way that it wasn't a great shock that Brighton won at Old Trafford, in the way that it wasn't a great shock that Tottenham beat them.
Yeah, let's get into specifics then, because we'll come on to those run of fixtures later. But Gregor, I wanted to ask about Andre Onana. You've got some views on his style of play and what the kind of energy that he gives off is not the kind of energy that you would want to see from a goalkeeper. Obviously, he made the mistake for the first goal last night. But what have you thought of him generally, rather than just focusing on that one mistake?
I'm not going to be scathing about him because it's early in his Manchester United career, and you know people were sort of raising the truth that Manchester United and Old Trafford has been like a vortex for talent for so long, and like is another talented player going to be drawn into that? It's too early to say that, but just generally speaking, like I said this the other day when you asked about who we preferred out of who we would choose out of Aaron Ramsdale and David Raya, and I always prefer, and I think defenders generally speaking always prefer a goalkeeper who's calm and measured, and he's not that. He's extrovert. He is someone who, you know, he draws the eyes, and often it's for good things. You know, he's talent with the ball at his feet, but sometimes it's like it raises your hair as well. So But as I say, I'm not going to... He was outstanding in the Champions League last year. Like, we all know the numbers. I think he kept the most clean sheets in the Champions League for Inter Milan. You know, made the most saves in that, you know, the metric that, you know, now kind of how many goals are prevented by goalkeepers.
Yeah.
He's a good goalkeeper. He's had a tough start. But we've seen this time and time again at Manchester United. And, you know, the fear is that another good player is wobbling.
Mm. There is a fact here, isn't there? You know, you mentioned that keeping clean sheets, and it makes me think about the stat I recited about Jan Oblak and keeping lots of clean sheets.
Absolutely.
In Atletico Madrid's team. He was in an Inter Milan team that was well drilled and got to the final of the Champions League, built on having a good structure defensively, wasn't he?
I mean,
so you then come to Manchester United and all players become exposed, don't they, a little bit?
At the moment, he's conceding one goal every 2.7 shots on target.
Yeah.
That's not sustainable.
Yeah.
You can't concede if you have three shots on target against Manchester United. At the moment, on average, one of them's going to go in.
Yeah, Martin, you were talking, just sorry to interrupt, but you were talking before, just to Gregor's point about goalkeepers. Before we came on the show, you were reminiscing about Terry Venables and some of his views on goalkeepers and what he liked to see.
There was it was two things actually. It was one. Venables, when he was with, I want to say, Steve McClaren. And one of the things that Paul Robinson was in goal, and Terry was advocating changing the goalkeeper for a long time before he did. And then finally Steve changed it for a match that was like everything was on this match, and it was probably the wrong time to change it. But it was Paul Robinson that was in goal. And What unnerved Terry about Paul Robinson is he thought if the game went quiet, he would do something to make you notice that he was there, make the manager or whatever notice that he was there, he'd suddenly go chasing out to the corner flag or whatever, you know, to retrieve a situation that actually the fullback was probably going to cover anyway. And it was almost like, look, I'm still here, boss. I'm still, you know. And he did, he was trying to explain, look, we know you're there. We're very happy you're not touching the ball. We're very, very happy you're not involved. Don't think you don't have to do anything. Jordan Pickford used to be a bit like that. He's less so now, but he used to be a bit like that. He'd suddenly come tearing out for no apparent, you know, and it was almost that he hadn't been involved and he wanted to remind everyone that he was still there, still watching the game. But the other thing that I remember, and it goes to Gregor's point about he's an extrovert, is this Jose Mourinho's point about what he wanted from defenders and why he didn't rate or want David Luiz. It was just very, very insightful. What he wanted was defenders who were pessimists, and he thought David Luiz was too much of an optimist. That he goes forward, he never thinks anything's going to go wrong. If he brings the ball into the other half, he never thinks the move's going to be broken down and you could be caught on the counter-attack. Far too optimistic. He wanted a centre-half who thought everything was about to fall apart at any given moment, and therefore he had to be in his position. Strikers can be optimists. If you have a shot at goal, the striker's got to think, the goalkeeper's going to spill it, I'm going to run in and we're going to be 1-0 up. Defenders have got to be pessimists. If you look at England in the 2014 World Cup against Uruguay, England get knocked out because Gary Cahill thinks Steven Gerrard is going to get the ball, he's going to cut that pass out, and Gerrard misses it, and Suarez is gambling because he's an optimist, but Gary Cahill should be a pessimist. He should be thinking, I've got to cover this because Steven Gerrard's not going to get it. And Gary Cahill doesn't start moving at the same time as Suarez, and that's why Suarez is in on us. It wouldn't have happened had John Terry been at centre half, because John Terry was a pessimist.
I think, I'm just reliving with Scottish eyes that moment. Anyway, sorry about that. United have finally gone down the route of having a footballing goalkeeper, and I think that was well overdue, to be honest. Brilliant as David De Gea is at shot-stopping, I think he was holding United back in terms of developing a more proactive style of play. However, the first requirement of a goalkeeper is to stop the ball going in the net. That is the number one requirement, and I'd say the number two requirement in the modern game is being able to play. Now, this is where United are at. They're a big enough club that they shouldn't be making a binary choice. Because if you look at Edison, He's incredible with his feet, and I mean, a bit of skill on Tuesday night was unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable.
And
he's perhaps an optimist, I would say. But,
yes.
But you know, Edison can play football.
Quiet optimist.
He's not that quiet.
No.
I mean, Alisson can play football, but can stop the ball going in the net. David Rea, I think, is a fantastic goalkeeper, and he can do both as well. Vicario, who's come from nowhere, looks like he can do a bit.
Onana can do both.
Well, he should be able to do both. We've seen him do both, but he's not doing it at the moment, is he?
How important do you think it is that he fronted up last night and came out and spoke to the press, to Paul Hurst and the guys in Munich?
I thought that was important, and we do always note a lack of accountability and leadership in United, and that was him taking accountability.
Yeah,
he's playing in front of a very bad defence. You know, back four, which if I'm doing the comparisons game, I'm not sure any of those four would get into, I don't know, top seven teams, possibly. I don't think. So there's a mix of problems here, obviously. And I think Onana, on his performance level last year, looked like a top goalkeeper. His career history, bit patchy, I would say. But United should, you know, in every position, they should be able to look for the best, and they're not at the moment. They're still, you know, they buy Lisandro Martinez, great qualities but obvious drawbacks. You know, Anthony has one great quality and lots of drawbacks. Like the recruitment is I think they pay a lot of money for players which aren't the sort of complete package and aren't the complete footballer in comparison to their rivals, and they might have done it again with Onana. Early days, I'm not writing him off at all. Mm. But, you know, he has to be as good as Edison. He has to be as good as Alisson.
Yeah.
That's the level United are trying to compete at. He's not, you know, if Aaron Ramsdale is now Arsenal's number two goalkeeper, he's not, I wouldn't say at the moment, looking as good as Arsenal's number two.
Like, the thing you've got to say about, again, no one's writing off Onana. That would be foolish. But it's so many, all the players that United have signed, they've not all been, you know, they shouldn't have all been duds. It's because of the dysfunction. It's because there's no like clearly defined sort of philosophy or style of play, or it's been shifting from one thing to the next. So you could have that same conversation about Pogba at Manchester United. He didn't fit in anywhere in the team, and now when you look at Onana, and he's asked to been asked to build a play from the back, and that's what Ten Hag wants to do. There was one point where he gave it to Lindelof last night, and Lindelof was like, just looked frenzied, and he ran across his own 18-yard box because he knew he had to look like he was doing something that wasn't just giving it back to Onana. And you know, he's been asked to do something. When he did that at Inter Milan, like they were so intelligent the way they played. They'd drop the defender really deep and almost draw the press to play through the lines, or he would play a ball, you know, beat the first line as well, because he is good at that. But it was really smart. It was intelligent, and there's just no evidence of that. So that's why the dysfunction around Onana and every other player we can talk about that's failed at Manchester United, the dysfunction has been a big reason for that. It's not just them alone.
It becomes horses for courses. If you think that Onana fell out with his national team manager at the World Cup in 2022, and one of the reasons was he kept bringing it out at the back. He kept trying to play football from the back, and Rigobert Song didn't think Cameroon had the players in the back four to do that. And in the end, they fell out, and that was the reason that he lost his place in the Cameroon team, and that he wasn't playing for Cameroon, and now he's back in, which is great. But it was all to do with Song. It's all well and good us having a goalkeeper that wants to do that and can do that, but then you've got to have the players to make that work. Song didn't think that Cameroon did. Manchester United don't look as if they've necessarily got the players to make that work. The thing that Guardiola does, he's got a footballing goalkeeper, but he's got a footballing back four as well, or back three, or whatever he's playing at this particular moment, back two and a half or something like that. But he's got players around that the goalkeeper can knock it to and look comfortable on the ball. Onana is playing to Manchester United players that look terrified. Now, whether it is the situation at the moment where they're under so much pressure that's causing it to happen, or whether it's just players that aren't particularly comfortable on the ball. We all know defences where there's one guy that isn't as comfortable on the ball as the rest, and football is now sophisticated, so that the press is on the other three guys, and they force the ball onto the guy they know isn't as good distributing it. That's what will happen with Manchester United.
They are, of course, missing quite a lot of players. If you think, I'm thinking about
Luke
a moment.
Luke Shaw's a big one.
Andre Onana, exactly. Mm-hmm. Played a lovely clipped pass to Sergio Reguilón, took it down on his chest, and immediately passed the ball to a Bayern Munich player. So there is, as you say, Greg, a wider context around Onana. I want to move on and come back to Martin's point, because you mentioned the next match against Burnley, and you talked about optimism and pessimism. When you look at United's fixtures coming up, they've got a Manchester derby on the 29th of October, but before then, they have seven games. Burnley, Crystal Palace in the EFL Cup, Crystal Palace again at home, Galatasaray at home, Brentford at home, Sheffield United away, Copenhagen at home. If you needed a nice run of fixtures to try and get your season off to a decent start before a massive game, that is about as good as it gets, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Martin, you've written a column on the website this morning talking about those slightly worrying signs for United and making slight comparisons with the Winter of Discontent and 1978 and all that.
1978, it was the last time they conceded three or more goals in three consecutive matches. Was December 1978, which is right in the middle of the Winter of Discontent, Jim Callaghan era, Labour government and strikes and everything. And they came ninth that season. People think Dave Sexton then got the sack. He didn't. Dave Sexton didn't get the sack for another 2 years. But that run of fixtures is great. But it's why you're thinking it's great is because we are looking at Manchester United and thinking it's Manchester United. Those matches are all easy games or winnable games, shall we say, for Manchester United. But actually, Manchester United, in their last 35 away matches, have lost 18 games. Of the teams that have been in the Premier League throughout that time, there's only one team in the Premier League with a worse away record than that, which is West Ham, who've managed to lose 20 matches away from home in that period in time. So we are judging Manchester United on everything that we know about the club for the last 20, 30 years. You're not judging them as the club they are at the moment, where that run of fixtures, which should be what gets their season going, really. It should start this Saturday at Burnley. But they've still got to raise their game from their current run of form. Because in their current run of form, 35 matches isn't just, that isn't this season. There's only two or three of them that have been this season. That's going back, I think, to about March 22 or something like that. So they've played all those sorts of games in that period of time and have managed to lose 18 out of 35 matches away from home.
Yeah. Johnny, to wrap up the United segment, looking at those games, and I asked this question because myself and James on the editing floor just before coming on the show were teeing up Paul Hurst to write a similar kind of piece, so we'll see if you say the same things. What would be, if there was one thing to look at the United team, whether it's get some confidence in Onana, get Sofyan Amrabat in the team, make sure Rasmus Højlund keeps scoring. He scored, of course, last night. Good for him to get off and running. What would be the one thing you'd be looking at to try and implement for Ten Hag?
As
you can have two if you want.
As we've been saying, the whole thing is a dysfunction at the moment, and we could go through the department. So all of what you've said, Tom, really, I guess the single biggest thing you always come back to United is always the midfield, and that's we could have had this conversation 10 years ago and come to the same conclusion. I think a lot starts in there. So Amrabat, if you're looking for magic ingredients, is he going to be the one? Because one of the issues that defence has got is United, who try and go man-to-man in midfield, don't have the legs to do it, and they let so much come through. So that's a beleaguered defence right from the start. But it's also a midfield which is struggling to create a lot at the moment. So again, the game plan just seems to be, and we could have said this 5 years ago, let's knock it to Marcus and see if he's on form today. Because
which they did a few times last night
And thankfully for United, he's been on form a lot in the last 5 years. But that is still their best plan of scoring a goal. So I think Casemiro is shouldering so much on his at the moment. He's such an intelligent footballer that it's almost like he realised last night that we need a bit of help in the box here, so he goes and turns into a striker for the last 10 minutes. But the one thing he's not capable of doing anymore is covering massive spaces. We know that. He's too old for it. He can't cover the huge gaps that United midfield leave. And you could say the same of Eriksen. So they need to start getting some control of the game. And you know, Amrabat, Eriksen and Casemiro going to be a combination? Is Mason Mount going to come back? I think if they could find something in there that they could build out from it.
Yeah. But it's all the thing is, it's the old adage about players always getting so much better when they're not in the team. I mean, what we're seeing now is, oh, when we get Mason Mount back, it'll be different. You're thinking, but everyone was saying that Mason Mount hadn't started well at Manchester United before he got injured, and now suddenly he's the answer. Amrabat, who was a player that I absolutely love and that I advocated West Ham should have won the Conference League final, walked straight over to Amrabat and said, we're losing Declan Rice, do you want to come and join us? Should have that. I mean, he's a wonderful player, I think, and was wonderful for Morocco in the World Cup. But he hasn't kicked a ball in the Premier League. You know, that's a lot of heavy lifting a guy's doing without kicking a ball in English football. And we know how difficult it is, because we've seen Fernandes at Chelsea go from a World Cup and looking like he can make a midfield tick and playing for Chelsea. And you're thinking, well, where was that player? It's because the league is really, really difficult. So the idea that Amrabat comes in on a charger and saves Manchester United, you know, it could happen, but it's a lot to ask.
Yeah, we'll have to see how they get on, whether Sofyan Amrabat is the answer to all Manchester United's problems. There's plenty of reaction that you can read on the Times website now. Not only Martin's article, but also Paul Hurst's analysis, which should be live by the time you're listening to this. Moving on, there's definitely some optimists in North London, aren't there, after Arsenal's resounding win against PSV Eindhoven last night. Alison Rudd in her piece today saying it is 6 years since Mikel Arteta's team competed at this level in Europe, but absence clearly made the heart grow fonder rather than out of touch with what would be required against opposition who, while outclassed on the night, will still be hopeful of finishing runners-up in the group. Gregor, it's an absolute stroll, wasn't it? They're going to win the Champions League.
I don't think they're going to win the Champions League, but we discussed this before. It was a reminder that, you know, despite their absence for a long period of time, the power of the Premier League, the might of the Premier League, means that, you know, even though they're coming up against a team who are leading the Dutch league, finished second last season, the gulf between the Premier League and the rest is enormous. So they have a chance to go deep in the competition. You know, this it says everything that this summer PSV sold one of the best players, Sangare, to Nottingham Forest. You know, a club who will be battling relegation probably.
Yeah.
So I think this just as a reminder that yes, Arsenal were brilliant. They were on the front foot from the off. Saka was on fire. But I think it's just a reminder that, you know, despite all the stuff that Arsenal have been through and their absence from this competition for a long time, you know, probably the Premier League has advanced more in that period than the Champions League has, than the rest. So Arsenal being back in this competition means that, you know, they're in with a chance of going deep in it.
Yeah, on that topic, we'll come back to the point about the Premier League and the rest of Europe when we talk about Newcastle and AC Milan later. Johnny, on that point about Arsenal, I was thinking last night, the goals were going in and we're deciding how we're going to lay out both the paper and the website and we're looking through various pictures. And there was one particular image of Gabriel Jesus, Martin Odegaard, Declan Rice and Bukayo Saka in the same image. And I thought, that's the picture. It wasn't a particularly amazing picture. It didn't show a goal. But I was like, there's four players and they are close to being world class, top level European class anyway. With this Arsenal team, because they've got such a young manager and because they've been near last season, at what point do we say they're there now? Is these moments like that? Do we go, they're there now? They've actually made it. They're a top level European team.
I think they are there actually, because look, they're a top level Premier League team, and because of what Gregor's saying, that makes you now a top level European team. They will go deep. Newcastle can probably, I know we'll come to them, they can probably get through their group as well, tough as it is, because that's how good the Premier League is. Probably a decent picture choice, because I would say that the the power, the I'm trying not to use the word the vibe, but I will. The Do vibe, it. The vibe of Arsenal under Arteta, it kind of rests on the chemistry of players. It creates very powerful chemistries between players of a similar style and age group and all that sort of stuff. And the goals they scored was, you know, the Saka, Trossard, and Gabriel Jesus vibe was absolutely fantastic for all of them. And I do feel after a stodgy start to the season where he's trying to play around a little bit with formations and using 31 of them or whatever he said to try and get more control of the game, I feel he's gone a little bit back to last year where it was about speed of the game, speed of attacks, combination play between really talented footballers. Gabriel Jesus, having sort of sat out those first couple of games, is now back in terrific form. And with that dynamism going forward, they will trouble anybody. They really will. Mm. They will be they're I think they're well set up for Europe. They're really, really likely to score in every game. It was a mystery to me they didn't go all the way to the Europa League final last year. They kind of threw that one away because they had it there for themselves. So they'll be, you know, they'll be right up there in the Champions League.
Yeah. The other thing that they've done, of course, is add strength in areas where they needed it, and also competition. We talked, Gregor, on Monday's show quite interestingly about Arteta and David Raya and Ramsdale and swapping goalkeepers. Martin, I thought it was quite interesting. I think a lot of people, myself included, perhaps assumed that Ramsdale would come back in. He didn't. Raya played. And thinking back to the conversation you were having earlier about calmness and things, there was a moment in the first half where it was all hectic, it was usual Arteta Arsenal, and he caught the ball, I think, from either a cross or a corner, and he did that exaggerated fall on the floor that goalkeepers do, where they're going,
Alisson likes that one,
stop it for a minute, and he put his hand up. There were loads of players obviously screaming, give me the ball, and he went, stop it, let's just wait a minute. Martin, I wanted to come to you and ask, does this suggest that he's pushing towards being the new number one over Ramsdale, or do you see it? I wanted to ask your opinion on the whole switching goalkeepers thing that we discussed on Monday.
Yeah, I thought I did a little bit in the column on Tuesday about it, and I think it's very, very interesting what Arteta said about substituting goalkeepers. Not in terms of who starts or whatever, not in terms of switching them, but literally in terms of making a change during a game and bringing a goalkeeper on as you would an outfield player, because no one's ever thought of it, no one's ever done it. Unless there's a complete calamity going on, unless there's an absolute crisis, and then you might change the goalkeeper if you think someone's ruined.
Or penalty kicks are coming.
Penalty kicks. You know, totally different circumstances. He is talking about a situation in the game where he thinks he's got a guy on the bench that would be better suited to the game that he's watching than the guy that's out there. And I think that's really, really interesting, because no one's ever considered it before. And yet, he's obviously looking at his goalkeepers, and he's seeing two very different players with two very different sets of attributes, as you would with outfield players. We judge outfield players in that way, but we sort of regard goalkeepers as this big sort of mass that everyone's as good as everything else, and therefore you don't change it. Why wouldn't you change it? If you had an aerial bombardment and you thought that this guy on the bench sitting next to you would be better than the guy that's out there, why wouldn't you then put him on and say, right, now let's have a think about this? So I thought that was fascinating. So if he is genuinely thinking like that, and he said there were two occasions in his career so far when he thought about changing the goalkeeper in the middle of a match, and neither time he had the courage to do it. Both times Arsenal ended up drawing. Both times he ended up regretting it. I think that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. So if he is now proposing that he doesn't actually operate with a first choice goalkeeper, and that he would change the goalkeeper halfway through the game, why should it be left to Pep Guardiola to come up with every single new idea in football? Why shouldn't Mikel Arteta suddenly go, I tell you what, I'm going to do something here that no one's ever done before?
But he might have surprised us, because you make that excellent point, because when the transfer story was happening and I was speaking to Gary Jacob, our Arsenal man, and that was my first question. Well, they've got Ramsdale. Why do they need Raya? I mean, am I that narrow-minded, Johnny? Are we all narrow-minded? Is Mikel, as Martin says, got a bright new trick up his sleeve.
Well, I was just looking at the ex-defender shifting in his seat as Martin's
Yeah, absolutely.
The middle of a match. I think it might be a little bit of a smokescreen from Arteta, to be honest. I think Reyes is number one man, and he's trying to
make Ramsdale feel better.
I think he is a little bit. I suspect. This is a guess, but I suspect it goes back to the run in the last season when Arsenal didn't get over the line because, let's say, they didn't handle the situation psychologically well enough. They played suddenly in two kind of tense, hyped up away, and I think Ramsdale might have been a representation. That you think of the Southampton game, which he found very difficult. Maybe just a little bit too emotional in that match. I love Ramsdale's personality, I have to say, and he was brilliant against Scotland when he was given that stage to be on. He responds really well. He might be a good one in the North London Derby, for example.
Yes.
But in those games, when it's about doing the job and being calm and getting across the line, maybe that's where he's looking at David Rea.
Yeah. Well, you lead me perfectly onto my final question, which is about that North London derby. Alison Rudd introed her piece from the match last night by saying there's probably no better way to prepare for a heated North London derby than by virtually strolling to victory in your opening match. So there is a contrast in terms of the type of game that they're going to get. Gregor, is this one of a rare times, again, it was something we were talking about before the show with Martin, where quite often we'd go into a North London derby knowing which team was better, whereas because of Ange Postecoglou's performances with Tottenham so far this season, even how great Arsenal are, we could be in for a bit of a cracker, couldn't we?
Yeah, it's rare that both teams go in with such a sort of positive atmosphere, certainly surrounding both teams.
0-0 incoming.
Yeah, probably. And it's going to be interesting tactically as well. I think, you know, Arsenal tend, since Arteta's been in charge, tended to have dominated, and often, you know, Spurs have been, you know, willing to cede control and try and play in the break. That's been the type of team they have, and because of the managers in charge. Now that's very much changed, and we'll have two teams who want to be the sort of main protagonists going head to head. So I can't call it. I think shocking.
Gregor Robertson sits on fence.
No, I mean, I think Spurs have got the wind in their sails, and I think the most interesting thing is that the way that they'll always try and build from the back, and I've been at a couple of Spurs games this season, and that comes with great risks, and there's a couple of games in which they've kind of got away with that a little bit. They've gifted opportunities, and if they do that to Arsenal, I think they're more likely to punish them. So that's one area of intrigue for me.
Just to return to the goalkeeper for 1 second. So why are you squirming at the idea of changing a goalkeeper mid-game as a defender?
I said this on Monday. It's kind of my natural instinct was always to be that you want a settled back four goalkeeper. You want to know about the relationships and stuff like that. And I acknowledged that the game is changing, and that might make me sound like old-fashioned now. So, but primarily, I would say when you're. I can't think of many instances for a club of Arsenal size who are going to be usually want to be the dominant force, why they would see attributes that they wouldn't just start with. If Raya can't come and catch the ball against a bunch of, like, I don't know, Sean Dyche's Burnley, he shouldn't be starting in the first place.
No, I get
so
that.
If he's better with the ball at his feet and they want to be the team who are taking the game to every opposition, they'll start with him.
No, I was just using the aerial bombardment just as an example. Another one would be if you were talking about the calmness aspect of it, of seeing a game out. Right, we get this guy now because he's calm, and we don't want someone dancing around in the air and getting everyone excited. We want to exude some calm.
I don't know when you want that though. Do you want someone who's excitable and overexcitable in the goals? And that's part of the reason why he signed Raya, I think.
Maybe when you're losing 2 or 3 nil in a big game. Which is, might, for Arsenal, as you say, would be a rare experience, but maybe.
I just think there's evolution going on all the time in football, and the Pep Guardiola thing of, we're going to play out the back, our goalkeeper is going to pass to you, and you've got to be prepared to take the ball. When you think where defenders take the ball now, like level with their own 6-yard box, yeah, and stuff like that, which was regarded as suicide before, if you started messing about with it there, you know, people passing across their own penalty area, which is the first thing on your first day of practice for your, you know, your school football team. The first thing you was told was never pass across your own penalty area. Oh, right, okay. I just think there's an evolution going on. Malcolm Allison, going all the way back to the 1970s, was saying, goalkeepers have got to be taught how to pass it. I've got to be taught how to play. Most of them don't even know. You should say, much to the annoyance of all the goalkeepers, goalkeepers don't even know how to kick the ball. Don't even know how to kick the ball properly. He said, you've got to train them to kick the ball properly to actually pass it. You've got to train them on technique. It's a great shame that he didn't live to see him being right, basically. Yeah. And Pep Guardiola proving him right.
He would have loved
things that he, yeah, he would have. Things that he was saying in the mid-70s and maybe even earlier about what the future of football would be, which is that your goalkeeper can play football like an outfield player.
Right. Mikel, it's all set up for you. North London derby, 1-0 up, you know what to do. Change that goalkeeper. Now, we've got to move on, chaps, because there's plenty more to discuss on the Game podcast. But if you are enjoying the show, make sure you're subscribed and make sure that you're checking out all the best action on the Times website now from these guys and Martin's column on Manchester United. Coming up next, we'll be talking Newcastle, Manchester City and our other highlights from the Champions League. Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Newcastle United, back in the Champions League, back in the San Siro, back in the big time with a 0-0 draw. We were all teed up, we were sat in the office. Thankfully, I wasn't on the late shift, it was James's job. And as I left and walked out the door, we have 10 minutes left and he said, it's going to be bloody 0-0. And it was, but a good point for Newcastle. I want to start with Martin Hardy's piece, which he did. He was over there for us covering the game. He said, Newcastle must sharpen their attack. Spirit alone will not be enough in Europe. Johnny, of course, that spirit has been something we've complimented Eddie Howe and his team for. Do you agree with Martin?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, there's a need for Newcastle to keep evolving, as there is with all teams. But Newcastle particularly, I felt, you know, Eddie Howe did an incredible job last year in that very old-fashioned style, which was starting off with being a tight unit and being hard to beat and hard to break down, and being super intense, for getting the fitness levels up, all that kind of stuff. In terms of creativity and craft, they probably weren't at the level of some of their competitors in the Premier League, and now you've got the Champions League, which is essentially cup football, and then there's a need to create and make something in a tight game. They do need to expand their repertoire. I mean, it's not that Eddie's not trying with Harvey Barnes coming in. Tonali's supposed to offer a bit more creativity in midfield. And I think he will. He's had a dip a couple of games into his career. The big one for me is Isak versus Wilson. And you can see how trying to evolve towards Isak, who's got so much about him as a player. But it's not a reliable scorer. I'm not saying he's a reasonable finisher. Mm. But his career record tells you he's not a heavyweight goal scorer yet. He's young. So he keeps having to go back to Callum Wilson. But there's obvious drawbacks in Callum Wilson, who's made the most of his talent, but and you know, fabulous servant, but isn't probably, is he Erling Haaland level, blah blah blah, all that kind of stuff. So that is the future for Newcastle, and they were, if we're talking about scorelines that were misleading, I felt that was a bit of a misleading 0-0.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I'm not sure how Milan failed to score in that first half in particular.
I didn't feel it was a overwhelming swarm.
No.
It wasn't, you know, they looked a little bit shaky at times.
Shooting straight at Nick Pope.
They did, exactly. They kept banging it straight down his throat.
People saying, oh, Nick Pope made X amount of saves, and he had a very, very good game, Nick Pope. But that doesn't rather take into account how much AC Milan found him.
I'm going to have to stop you there, chaps, because you're teeing up Gregor Robertson to slag off Olivier Giroud again, which no one wants to hear. Not on this podcast. But just coming on to that point about AC Milan, and not being able to beat Newcastle. And then also looking at that team and lots of people saying, oh, Dan Burn's going to get torn to shreds here. Bloody hell, Jacob Murphy's starting a Champions League game. Does this, Martin, say, as much as it says about Newcastle and the spirit that Eddie Howe's team have got, does it also say quite a lot about the strength of the Premier League and the potential weakness of some of the other teams in Europe that, you know, Newcastle are realistically are getting a point and, you know, myself and Johnny disagreeing, but looking comfortable at times, at least.
That group, which everyone, when it came out, oh, in the group of death, in the group of death. But you look at that group, it could be anything. It could, you know, because none of those other teams, AC Milan, Borussia Dortmund, Paris Saint-Germain, huge names, huge European experience, certainly compared to Newcastle. But if you look at their domestic form at the moment, all of them, you know, where would they be in English football compared to, you know, what Newcastle did last season? So, I think Newcastle, it does epitomise it because you look at say the AC Milan team, and you go, oh right, so that guy there was the centre forward that couldn't get in Chelsea's team, and oh there's Ruben Loftus-Cheek who couldn't get in Chelsea's team, and there's Tomori who couldn't get in Chelsea's team, and you think, would they get in Newcastle's team? Those three players, any of those three players, and that how often does that happen? In a European tie, where you look at the other team and you go, oh, he was at Stoke, that fella. Yeah, he was all right, wasn't he? You know, and then you'll see that he's the main man at Sevilla or whatever.
Or at Real Madrid.
Or at Bayern Munich, by the way. All of whom have had players that you know, were involved with Stoke, I think, or West Brom or whatever. And so we are enormously blessed, really, with the quality of football that you watch from the elite teams in the Premier League week in, week out. And when they go into Europe, that shows it. And I wrote about, I think it was Brighton last season, and I think they were top five or top six. And I said, look, what you understand, if Brighton are in the top five in the Premier League, it probably puts them in and about the top 10 or 12 in the world. As a, you know, club sides in the world, and people, oh, that's ridiculous. How can Brighton be one of the top? Because if you're in the top five in the Premier League, that's where you are.
Just underline the point as well. Newcastle haven't, what is it, a couple of decades out of that competition, and they're 20th in the Deloitte Money League. AC Milan are 16th. Arsenal, again, what, 7 years out, they're 10th. So, you know.
Do you think that we've not?
The only thing I would say with the Deloitte Money League, they did have Fiorentina, I think, in the top six about 2 months before they went skint. So, you know,
it's a fluctuating.
Need some orders.
It depends which analyst you get, really. I think at the Deloitte Money League.
Do you think, Johnny, then, that we've not, maybe as viewers, as journalists, caught up with the rapid pace of change? You know, because when I was growing up, AC Milan, huge teams, Seydorf, all these huge, great names, things like that. Have we not actually switched on as football fans to the realities of what Martin's talking about?
Yeah, I think it is disorienting. And maybe it's we as football fans of a certain age, maybe a younger generation will just be used to this kind of pattern. I remember Steve Parrish telling me, and this was 8 or 9 years ago, so things have moved on further, but he had an email one day from Sampdoria, and you know, wanting to talk to him about, as I said, various partnerships. He was really excited. Crystal Palace, just back in the Premier League, and Steve, fan of a certain, football man of a certain age, Sampdoria, massive team, you know, blah, blah, Graeme Souness, Serie A. And he thought, you know, maybe they see Crystal Palace as the same level as them. Maybe, you know, maybe we've made it and we're going to have a partnership. And they just wanted to sell him players. And he was really disappointed, but the penny dropped that actually, in the food chain, Crystal Palace, and this was 8 years ago, were above Sampdoria. And that's what we've got to look at.
Which comes back to your point about Sangara and PSV and the transfers and where players go as well.
Brendan Aaronson last night playing Champions League football, you know, and he's a good player, but he was relegated last year, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. Medford Messi, wasn't it?
On Newcastle, that would take a slightly different spin. I think they've gone to San Siro after 2 decades out of this competition and got a draw. And their home form is going to be what dictates overwhelmingly how they do in the competition. But they will see after this
No, I'd say, I'm saying it's a good thing that they will almost look at this, and because I do wonder whether there was lots of coverage before the game, huge game. I saw lots of fans on Twitter saying, oh, it's a free pass for Newcastle.
Newcastle's underdogs.
Yeah, we're the underdogs, but actually they come out of it and go, no, these lot aren't up to much.
No. Exactly.
You shouldn't, no team that has qualified for the Champions League from the Premier League should go in there as grateful tourists. No, nobody. Nobody should go in there as grateful tourists. If Brighton were to get into the top four this season, they shouldn't go into the Champions League next season thinking, oh, we're plucky old Brighton, we're lucky to be here, I can't believe we've drawn this one or that one or whatever.
I mean, they would.
They would, of course they would.
But they make
but the reality is,
that's
right.
How you feel, but the reality is, the reality is, you know, West Ham won the Conference League last season, but actually, if you looked at the teams in the Conference League, West Ham were the team to beat. You know, West Ham were the team to beat. Aston Villa are the team to beat in the Conference League this season, without a shadow of a doubt. They're the team to beat because they come from this league that has got so much wealth and power. There was a famous meeting at Bayern Munich a number of years ago that, you know, in which highlighted the crisis in European football. They rejected the idea of a Super League, but it's one of those meetings that you can look at and think, this is when, you know, certain clubs started thinking about we need a Super League. And the meeting pointed out that Norwich, who come bottom that season, got more money for coming bottom of the Premier League than Bayern Munich earned for winning the Bundesliga.
Yeah. Johnny, Martin mentions a Super League there. We've obviously been on this podcast before talking about, it'd ruin the game. We've already got one, haven't we? It's called the Premier League, by the sounds of it.
Look,
about. Martin Ziegler writing this week that Premier League games outside the Saturday 3 p.m. window could all be live on television, could go even more. That's only going to bring in more money. We are the Super League.
I've thought that for years, that's the direction of travel. And one of the many things I couldn't get my head around with the ill-fated Super League project was, why would the top Premier League clubs want to empower Europe? Because the Premier League just needs to wait it out, and it's going to be the NBA or the NFL of football. That is the way it's going inexorably. We do have the new Champions League format next year, which is, I guess, Europe's response, and it's a UEFA attempt to start creating more of a league rather than a sort of knockout competition. So I think it's top five, isn't it? But in Premier League, will get in.
It's the top four. And then there's. Then there's a coefficient. There's a coefficient equation that we'd really have to stuff up for us not to be a country that got the fifth. Yeah.
There's an extraordinary way in which 11 Premier League teams could qualify for European football next season, and it would require things like, you know, cup winners knocking other people down in the league because you get a certain, you know, qualification for whatever. But it's the Premier League having five places will just, well, you know, it'll also skew the balance a bit more in terms of the money coming in for another club in the Premier League.
I certainly hope there aren't 11 teams in it next year, because we've only talked about three on this show so far. We've got to squeeze Manchester City in. We've got to move on. We're going to talk about Manchester City. It's only September. We're already in the stage of what else can you say about Manchester City? A 3-1 win. But I have got two things I want to say. Jeremy Doku already looks an incredibly exciting player. And looks, Gregor, as you were saying before the show in our planning chat, to have slightly given City, dare I say, another option in terms of the way they play.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were speaking about this before, and that City were kind of when City were struggling before, they went back to pass. That's all you heard Pep saying, you know, pass. This is us, this is our way. And since then, he signed, you know, a blistering winger, and, you know, bit of a kind of a line of them now, if you look at Grealish, but Doku is the most sort of thrilling of the lot in terms of his just pure pace, and I think not only is that like another string to the bow in the way that Haaland is another string to the bow in the way they can play direct now, I think it also, when he's always had players who hug the touchline, but when you have that big a threat on the touchline as a ball carrier, it creates space for others inside those little sort of inside channels. That's such an important part of the pitch now in terms of
with him hugging the touchline, just the inside
little,
from him.
Sort of half space, they call it, sort of kind of attacking space between a fullback and a centre half, such a kind of weak point, because you know, if you stretch the pitch, then and that can you get inside that channel, then you're looking at cutbacks. That's the kind of classic Man City goal. And I think having such, you know, dangerous ball carrying wingers with pace like that terrifies defenders and stretches them. I mean, you have to get tight. You can't just leave them to run at you at pace. And sometimes you might even want to double up. And I think that has a knock-on effect for the way that you'll see, you know, midfield runners exploiting those spaces between the lines.
And I was going to say Julian Alvarez would be the other two words I'd say if you're talking midfield runners.
Yeah.
Where he's already transforming in front of our eyes from a number nine to number nine, number 10, number 8, whatever.
Number 9.5.
Yeah, just a Pep creation who can do so many things. But his talent for making those runs is incredible.
So you've always tried to find those spaces, though. If you look back, if you think back a couple of years ago, how often do we see Kevin De Bruyne getting in that little half channel, inside half channel, and playing cross? And often used to be trying to create overloads. Yeah. So you would have another midfielder, and maybe the fullback coming up wide, and you'd have like three men, and they try to manufacture a way of getting Kevin De Bruyne on the ball to play in that cross. If you've just got one rapid winger that does the same thing, opens up that space for a runner, you know, it's another way of finding a way of getting inside, splitting the defence and getting into that little half channel, I think.
A little moment of applause for Rodri's passed goal into the bottom corner. Oh. That's one of my favourite things in football.
Defensive midfield.
Just a little pass into the bottom corner. It looks like he's barely touched it. Martin, we've just been talking about the Super League, us being a Super League. Manchester City are the super team. You know, we've talked about Bayern Munich. They looked good, but they did concede three against a hapless Manchester United. We're going to hopefully link into talking about Real Madrid and some of the other teams. But are City far and away already, and I know it's only one game, but far and away the favourites for this competition?
Well, there is this club, I don't know if anyone's heard of it, called Barcelona. And they've started it quite well. I think they scored the other night. And if you look at the way they've started the Liga, that's not too bad either. Everyone keeps talking about, it's all set up for City, Real Madrid. I'm not quite sure about that. I think it might be set up for City, Barcelona. But they're the team to beat, aren't they? They're quite clearly the team to beat.
On those two players, would you agree with Gregor and Johnny then, Doku and Alvarez, that they... We've got a player that's new and then in Doku and a player that is we've seen before but seems to be adapting. Are you excited about both of them and what they can
absolutely,
bring to
absolutely, because, you know, you look to Alvarez as he's Harden's deputy and then suddenly he's Harden's partner. And you're thinking, this is not what we expected at all. Doku, I love the way that Pep comes in and everyone changes to do whatever Pep's doing at the time, like inverted fullbacks or whatever, which everyone's now got and no one had until Pep went, well, you know, you can do this with a fullback.
Luton don't, by
the way. Yeah, no, Luton, no. But but what I love is that he's gone, pass, it's all about passing. Everyone's gone, it's all about passing. He's gone, no, actually, it's about flying wingers. That's what it's about. And he's gone, what? No, it's about passing, wasn't it? Oh, where's our flying winger?
Going old school, back to the days of Andrei Kanchelskis and Ryan Giggs
exactly, flying. Exactly, this is it. And you can argue, obviously, there's nothing new under the sun because, you know, there's plenty of good teams that have had flying wingers before and you named a cracking one there. But, I just think it's great. He's an innovator, and it's a pleasure to watch him do it. It's a pleasure to see the season start and think, what's he going to do this year that everyone is going to be copying within about 4 months or 5 months? And here we go.
We saw enough from Bayern too to suggest that they're going to be
front four.
Yeah, Gnabry, Musiala was
beautiful.
We didn't really touch on them much.
Yeah,
Sané and obviously Harry Kane. Like. And then they've got Coman to come on and Tell, who came on and scored. Like, their firepower.
He's a lovely player.
Their firepower is going to give them a chance.
Well, you're mentioning the other teams, and that's how I wanted to finish the show. Champions League, obviously, back. I do feel it's one of the competitions where we do really engage with all the other teams as well. So I wanted to ask for your favourite moments from the other games. Martin, perhaps yours is Barcelona. I'm going to go first with the moment as I was sat in the offices last night and Leonardo Bonucci came on the screen during Real Madrid and Union Berlin's match, which was obviously the early kickoff. And basically all on cue, about four people went, hey, that's Bonucci, because I'm sure I'm not the only one, well maybe I am the only one, who hadn't even noticed that he'd moved to Union Berlin. Still up to his old ways, and perhaps was telling that when once he went off was when they finally conceded a goal with a ball bouncing around in the box. You do wonder whether he was still on the pitch. He might have hooked it away just before Jude Bellingham tapped it in. Gregor, I'm going to come to you first because I think I know what you're going to say for, in terms of the other moment that caught your eye.
I've got a couple. I mean, the first is, you know, Brendan Rodgers has always been an innovator. You can't win a game, Champions League game, 11, in 11 games with 11 men. Try and go down to 9 men maybe and see if we can do it that way. Nope. But the other game was Galatasaray, because, you know, a few people have thought they might be kind of, you know, not dark horses to win it, but to go to do something in the in the competition this year, because of, look at their team. They had Lucas, again, a lot of former Premier League players. Torreira, that was at Arsenal. Hakim Ziyech, Wilf Zaha, and Tete, once of Leicester, came on to and combined to score the equaliser. They went 2-0 down against Copenhagen and had a spirit of comeback. You've got Dries Mertens, Mauro Icardi. They've got Ndombele and Davinson Sanchez, who just left first to go on the bench there. So it's like there's some, not huge names, but like very recognisable names there, and I think they've had a right a decent go. And that was looked like a hell of an atmosphere when they scored in the 86th and 88th minute to get a draw there. So I'll be interested to see how they go in the rest of the competition.
You'd look good in a Galatasaray shirt, actually. We might have to sort that out for the next time we discuss the Champions League. Johnny, any other teams or moments that caught your eye?
Well, look, I quite enjoyed Rafa Leao just falling over while attempting it.
That was good fun.
It made me feel better, because I'm making my return to five-a-sides on Friday night, and it might be a Rafa Leao moment, but I can claim it's one of them. Jude Bellingham, the eyes are drawn to him so much, and right at the end of that match where he hooked in the 94th minute winner was a brilliant moment, because 5 minutes before he had this a confrontation with Frederick Ronno, the Union goalkeeper, who just went down quite easily in the box, and as he got up, Bellingham just got in his face, and I won't repeat what he said, but it was just pure Brummy invective. And he turned from you know, super footballer, just into a kid on the park again. He's such a human being for such a superstar, and it was another Jude moment.
Just very quickly on the superstar thing, though, because the goal was a tap-in, and very fortunate, we should say, but it struck me that even on a pitch that included Luka Modric and things, this Real team are already looking to Jude Bellingham to make stuff happen.
You could see it coming. They were struggling to break them down, and I was saying to myself, it'll have to be Bellingham doing something, and sure enough it was. And I can't remember who the player it was, he took the ball off, but there's no way anyone else was going to get that tap in. There's somebody else trying to do the David Nugent and he just whipped it off and put it in. But yeah, it's his team, and he made some incredible runs that they weren't picking up, and you'd sort of think there's actually a lot more Jude Bellingham to come for them if they can get him the ball enough.
Martin, Barcelona, the ones you caught your
eye
elsewhere.
Barcelona, but that's Barcelona look good. But, on a completely trivial point, I liked the fact that Newcastle looked like Newcastle, and they returned to European football for 20 years and decided not to wear some away strip that looked nothing like them. They were wearing black and white stripes. If AC Milan had been wearing their proper kit, Newcastle could have worn their proper kit as well and worn black shorts and black socks and actually looked even more like Newcastle, as opposed to looking like Notts County or Juventus. And I loved the fact that Red Star Belgrade walked out against Manchester City and looked like Red Star Belgrade. They didn't have some weird every kit on that was like sort of black or navy blue or fluorescent yellow or something like that. They wore what I remember as Red Star Belgrade: red and white striped shirts, red socks, red shorts.
United's kid.
I like United. I said it last week. I don't look anything like United, but I did that joke last week about that. So that's okay, because the team don't either. But actually, I quite like that kit, because I love that tricolour Brazilian thing where you've got three stripes going on. I love that, but it doesn't look much like United, but I do like the kit. But I thought Red Star walking out and going, oh yeah, that's Red Star Belgrade, I remember them.
I think it'd be good fun, given I'm sure our listeners are slightly sceptical about your feelings towards Manchester United, if we bought you the Manchester United kit, Martin. So maybe that's
something
we could
happen.
Do you
know, I said to my missus last night, I don't wear football kits, but I said to my missus last night, if I was a kid and I supported Manchester United, that would be the Man U shirt.
Sounds like he wants it, listeners.
Yeah,
you
know, I would. I really like it. I'm sorry, but I do.
You know what to
you
do.
You know, I like the kit a lot more than
now,
I like.
Now, just before we go,
Manchester
we are in
United
danger
too,
of being an anti-goalkeeper show because we're not mentioning Ivan Provodal's last-minute equaliser for Lazio. Because you're all being too cool. You're trying to think of alternative things when there's this one staring you straight in the face. Bill Edgar has done a brilliant piece about where that header ranks among goals scored by goalkeepers. So you can read that on the Times website now.
It's worth watching that go back, which you can do if you read the piece, because it's an incredible run he makes.
It's a great run.
It's not it's not just he's not standing there and it hits him.
Yeah.
He
which
makes
is
the late run.
Which is another part of goals with goalkeepers. Sometimes they get in the box and they go, "What do I do now?" He knew exactly what he was doing.
The Carlisle goalkeeper, was it Carlisle?
Jimmy Glass.
Where the goalkeeper kept him up.
Yeah, it was. He kept him in the league. Yeah.
Absolute crackers. They're all listed in Bill Edgar's piece, so make sure you check it out. Now we are going to finish. Instead, I thought we were going to finish. But my colleague here, Gregor Robson, has got a brand new best mate. I thought it was me, but it's not. It's a famous celebrity. And I thought I was going to tee him up nicely just to talk about his really interesting piece about Brighton and their fans before they return to Europe. But I'm actually going to embarrass him with the fact that he's just got an email from Norman Cook, a.k.a. Fatboy Slim, to say thanks for the piece, mate. So come on, tell us all about your Brighton piece and your new best mate.
Best mate is pushing it, but it was... You know, I'm not starstruck that often, but
he's loving it.
Interviewed Fatboy Slim, for a piece about Brighton's journey from homelessness and the war years, as everyone I spoke to described the period of about almost a decade and a half between like 1995 and 2011 when they moved into the new stadium at Falmer, and all the struggles they had to. You know, first to get rid of the owners who sold the Goldstone ground, then to after they were ground sharing in Gillingham to get the club back to the city, and then to campaign to get the new ground at Falmer. So it's been I think just the Brighton's journey into Europe has been an opportunity just to sort of remind ourselves of the journey that they've been on, and Fatboy Slim has been part of that because he moved to Brighton. In the 80s to go to college, and he went with a flatmate because they lived a stone's throw from the Goldstone, and he said he fell in love with the club, and then when they were at their lowest point, he says it was basically blackmail by Dick Knight, the then chairman, who kind of took him out for lunch and over several bottles of wine said, I think if we don't if we don't get some investment, we're going to have to sell. I think it might have been Bobby Zamora or someone. And so, he was kind of tugging at his heartstrings. And so he sponsored the club, and then he invested some money to... He's still a shareholder, minority shareholder. But, it was great to talk with him and other people about the journey and, the remarkable rise of Brighton that shows no sign of stopping.
Absolutely. And you're wearing blue and white, I noticed. So I'm sure you'll pretend it's for Scotland, but maybe
it's not a fact or whatever. It's just a little steer that if listeners don't know this. If you like Right Here, Right Now by Fatboy Slim, if you like that piece of music, the sample is this amazing instrumental track by a group called the James Gang. It's a track called Ashes, the Rain and I. And it's all there. And what it does is the sample he takes is actually from the fade out. It says this brilliant instrumental track is fading out. You hear the sample that is right here, right now. But it's a brilliant piece of music. Ashes, the Rain and I by the James Gang.
I'm going to look that up.
Yeah.
There we go.
Martin Samuel on football kits and on music. That is the special game podcast spin-off that we're all waiting for. Johnny Northcroft, Martin and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. And we wish Brighton luck, of course, in their debut, in fact, in Europe against AEK Athens. Thanks very much for joining me, gentlemen. We'll have plenty to discuss on Monday's show. And maybe we'll be talking about Mikel Arteta substituting his goalkeeper. We'll see you then.